Welcome to this edition of Eye on the Peninsula Current Affairs program on RPPFM Local Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Piers Cunningham. In the first half of the program, paramedics are still doing it tough with the number of assaults increasing. And we look at the local ice and drugs issue with Minister Martin Foley. But today we begin with the Royal Commission handed down 227 recommendations to the Victorian Government last week. The recommendations are to be used as a reform to stop family violence across Victoria. What does this mean to our local communities? Joining Deborah Maher is Kathy Kaplan, OAM, founder and president of Impact for Women, a volunteer organisation making a difference to the Victorian women and children fleeing from extreme violence at home. We'll also hear a comment from Rosie Batty on domestic violence.
Kathy, welcome to Eye on the Peninsula. What will the implications of the Royal Commission's recommendations, such as safe houses and the police taking on a bigger role, mean to the people on the Peninsula and Frankston area living with domestic violence?
It's going to mean a lot, as in all regions of Australia and particularly in Victoria. Refuges and the agencies that deal with family violence are really poorly resourced. Incredibly poorly resourced, and Impact helps those in the Peninsula and Frankston areas, but so much more needs to be done. But at the same time, I need to let you know that the family courts in Frankston lead the way with how they have coordinated services and interface with other agencies, and that's one of the recommendations that the Commission makes, to follow that lead and that example. So that's the good news in the Peninsula and Frankston areas.
What are the statistics of domestic violence cases on the Moynta Peninsula and Frankston areas?
I'm afraid I can't answer that specifically, but we would imagine that it's the same as elsewhere in Australia, which is one in three women experiencing physical violence in her lifetime, most often by a current or former intimate partner. But it's also true that when women and children have to flee their home, they're often taken to another region of Victoria so that they're not in. They need to leave work, they need to leave school, so that they're away from their abusive partner. And that's a real pity, because the woman who loses her job, the children who have to be relocated instead of the perpetrator, and that's another recommendation in the Commission, that it should be the other way around.
Rosie Batty, a high-profile advocate against family violence and is now heading up a new Victim Survivors Advisory Council, had this to say.
There's a certain path unfolding to me at the moment, which is educating people in the statistics of family violence.
Yeah.
You know, one in three women are affected, one woman a week is killed. And to really talk about focusing discussion not just around the victim and the woman, but actually questioning the behaviour of the perpetrator.
Kathy, do you know if one of the recommendations the Royal Commission's handed down is around educating the perpetrator, as Rosie has just advocated?
Yes, absolutely. The programs dealing with perpetrators that we've currently got are entirely insufficient. Increased monitoring and insight is urgently needed. A relatively small number of repeat offenders account for a disproportionate amount of the reported family violence incidents. And to that end, the Commission recommended that specialist panels that assess the risk from a repeat offenders need to be extended across Victoria. So there are some programs currently available, but there needs to be many more, and it needs to be far more deep and more evidence-based therapies available as well.
And I think with the police putting up a force where they focus a lot on domestic violence, hopefully what will come through there is looking at mental issues as well, mental health of these perpetrators that need to be addressed as well.
Well, not just the perpetrators, but the victims too. The police district that covers Moorabbin and Kingston and those areas, this task force, Alexis, is based at the Moorabbin Police Station. And that's a pilot program with the Victorian Police, and their focus is family violence and mental health.
The Victorian Premier Daniel Andrews says there should be more support and safety hubs created. Risk assessment framework for family violence should be revised. Report calls for Victoria Police to make family violence a core business, and of course this would help the problem immensely. The Victoria State Government allocated $80.6 million to family violence in 2014-15, but the implementation of the Commissioner's recommendations will cost much more than this amount and will need to take priority in the state and federal budgets. It's going to be an interesting time, Cathy, to see which money tree they'll use to fund more safety hubs and increase the number of police to deal with family violence. So what do you think about that?
Look, I support everything he said. He's taken those key recommendations from the report, and I'm very excited to hear him say that the Victorian government is supportive and has every intention of fulfilling those promises. But the money issue is a serious issue. Where is the money going to come from? I don't have the answer to that. Mm. I hope Mr. Andrews does, but also where will it be put to first? So the $80 million that he put into family violence in 2014-15, that was really good too, but it didn't go down to the grassroots. At the moment, we still have too many women fleeing extremely dangerous situations, and there's not enough places, safe places for them to go. So it's great to put some money and resources into the higher level issues surrounding family violence, because that's urgently needed, but so is immediate response. It needs to be done immediately too, and that requires a lot of money.
How can local communities be helped by Impact for Women?
Well, Impact is a volunteer-run charity. We don't have paid staff or premises, and we aim to make a difference to Victorian women and children fleeing extreme violence at home. So any donations that are given to us, we're at the moment raising funds for safety cards. Now, a safety card looks like a credit card. It can be worn over or above a woman's clothing. If she presses a button or rips it from the cord or the perpetrator rips it from the cord, it does three things. A, it sends immediate GPS coordinates so that the agency knows to immediately get help sent out to her. B, it sets up an audio recording of the altercation. And C, that audio recording is admissible in court. I, together with my colleague, visited the police a couple of weeks ago and introduced them to this technology. They were unaware of it. So it's going now through the bureaucracy that powers that be to see that it can be introduced. Impact is currently in the position of funding 15 of these with activation costs for a year that we can immediately issue to the police to then issue to women in need of them.
So I hope that Victoria Premier Daniel Andrews can get behind that and fund much more for women who are fleeing these terrible situations.
Go to our website, which is impactforwomen.org.au.
Great.
Or Facebook, Impact for Women.
Thank you so much, Cathy. We'll leave it there.
Cathy Kaplan, AOM, sharing her thoughts on the Royal Commission's recommendations into family violence. And if you or you know of someone needing help or advice on family violence, contact the Domestic Violence Hotline on 1800 656 463. Increasing numbers of assaults on paramedics is still dominating the news, with more incidents reported over the past couple of days. Last week, Ray Reid provided details about the situation on Eye on the Peninsula. This week, he has an update on the situation after he spoke with Ambulance Employees Association State Secretary, Mr. Steve McGee. Here is what Ray said.
Last week, we reported on a serious concern that has arisen amongst paramedics for their safety in undertaking their daily duties. The concern was stemmed from the release of a report from Ambulance Australia confirming that there were over 1,100 locations in and around Victoria listed as no-go zones, and the number of addresses listed had risen by a quarter in just 5 years. The increase in location had occurred in line with the rise in violence attributed to the level of ICE-related incidents, alcohol abuse and family violence. Australian Ambulance Employee State Secretary Mr. Steve McGee had stated in interviews about the matter that he wanted to see a no-tolerance approach to all incidents where violence occurred. His point was that all such incidents should be required to come before the courts to assess the level of mitigating circumstances and, where appropriate, penalise offenders. The Ambulance Australia report indicated that the Frankston Mooring Peninsula area combined are at the top of the number of locations listed in the no-go zones in the state. Last week, I spoke to Mr. McGee about our concerns at the high rate of addresses listed in and around the peninsula and sought from him some clarification on a few of the matters pertaining to no-go areas. In particular, what was the definition of a no-go zone? He advised that a no-go zone is any location or address where an incident occurs that is reported on by paramedics, where violence, either pushing, hitting, threatening language, etc., is encountered either by the offenders either at others or at paramedics themselves. A no-go zone is a warning to paramedics that the location in question may become subject to violence. Paramedics may do their own appraisal of the risk on arrival at a location, including identifying potential emergency exits from the location in case of a problem occurring, and may call for further assistance from police when necessary. According to Mr. McGee, once a location is listed on a no-go zone, it may stay listed indefinitely. At this time, there are no review processes. I also asked Mr. McGee if it is possible that the seasonal influx of tourists may have a bearing on the number of locations on the peninsula. Clearly, this is a very good idea. That way, not only can the location of the incident be noted, but also the private addresses of the individuals involved, wherever they lived, would further arm paramedics with valuable information. Mr. McGee went on to say that he had seen some of the TV campaigns running in other states and is in favour of whatever can be done to reverse this very concerning trend. He is also seeking a continued increase in the sharing of information between the police, ambulance and government bodies to help reduce the risk of assaults on paramedics. I'm Ray Reid for Eye on the Peninsula.
We'll bring you further details as they come to hand. There is a series of substance addiction education sessions run in Mornington by Peninsula Voice. The current three sessions are assisting families and friends who are dealing with loved ones who've had a substance addiction. Deborah Maher gathered this report with Victorian Project Officer Michael Miller from Family Drug Support.
In 2014, the then Liberal government brought in a review of the drug and alcohol sector. The outcome and implementation of that review, like any major change within the health sector, was always going to have some teething problems. Unfortunately, with the teething problems, it was individuals that the ones that fell through the gaps. So with the reforms in the sector, they were divided into two stages. Stage one being a reform in regards to counselling services and access into counselling services, and stage two being for rehabilitation accommodation and also for the youth sector. The Labor Party, with Mark Foley being the Community Services and Mental Health Minister, has that portfolio, and they're bringing about some changes. We hope that what we'll see coming is some significant changes, but with significant changes, there will, in my opinion, and many within the drug and alcohol sector, financial input. We can't bring about timely responses without having services available to people. That's really a major issue, because that's something that's not taking place until the reforms of stage one have been finalised and all the recommendations have been implemented. We have no idea of when that will take place, of what the date is.
What's the Peninsula Health doing, and how are they helping you?
Look, Peninsula Health, like many organisations, have struggled with some changes. They do have the intake and assessment for the Mornington Peninsula area, and they do have counselling services. And so they have changed quite a few things around, because initially it was taking quite some time for an individual to ring up and be able to access a counselling service, where people were initially being told that it could be, we'll return your phone call in the next couple of weeks. They've changed that around, so they're immediately getting through to people now, and then there is a gap in time between they can access a service. They are doing the best they can with the funding and their abilities to be able to perform at the moment.
Why would it be a good thing to decriminalise drugs?
The decriminalisation of drugs / possibly legalisation of drugs will take a government that is able to make some big decisions. But before making any decisions, we need to actually have the conversation and engage in a multitude of areas, from the community, from the drug and alcohol sector, from within the hospital system, from within police. And we've had some very significant ex-heads of police, including Ken Lay, the head of National ICE Task Force. We've had Mick Palmer, ex-head of the Australian Federal Police, all coming out and saying pretty much exactly the same thing. We can't arrest our way out of this. So with a young person or a person of any age that uses a substance, if we give them a criminal record for using a substance, How does that impact upon their lives? Does that help them getting a job in the future? Does it help them engage to services if that's something that they're requiring? Or is it merely something that they are tarnished with for the rest of their life, with not being able to potentially get into some industries? For what? For using a substance, which is something that over 45% of Australians have used in their lifetime? I think decriminalisation of all drugs is something that we should look at. I personally believe that is a positive thing, because especially coming from families don't need to get caught up in the legal system because their family member has been using substances. There's many things we can do to spend our money on, and one of them is not putting people through the legal system for doing something that 45% of the population has done.
Victorian Minister for Health, the Honourable Martin Foley, was questioned about his drug reforms. These are his comments.
Minister Foley, thank you for your time today. We know that Frankston and surrounding areas, including the Mornington Peninsula, are reaching worrying numbers of people with substance addictions. In 2014, I believe the Victorian Liberal government proposed the implementation of new drug and rehabilitation reforms in two stages, one being the implementation of drug cancelling services and access to cancelling services, and the other, better rehabilitation facilities and accommodation for people living with substance addictions. How far has your government gone with implementing these stages?
You're quite right. The Franks and the Mornington Peninsula area is one of a number of hotspots around the state where we've seen alcohol and drug and other combined issues come together in a particularly devastating way for community. The Victorian government's response to that, particularly as we've seen new drugs such as ICE, but not just ICE, the first of those was the almost $50 million package, the ICE Action Response, that was delivered last year. Within that, some $25 million was identified as a priority for community-based rehabilitation and community responses to alcohol and drug response. Those programs have now started around the state, including a range of services in the Frankston Peninsula area, which has been led by a Peninsula Health Consortium, the Frankston and Mornington Drug and Alcohol Service. And on top of that, a range of support for local community responses to how communities can build together that social capital response to the scourge of drugs.
If family and friends who are listening who do need help from the drug cancelling services now have access to these services readily available to them?
These services are off and running in local communities now. The strength of them is their embeddedness in local communities. Rather than a generalist statewide approach, the response that we put out was for local organisations to come together in a holistic way. But what's behind that? Are there housing? Are there family violence issues? Are there any number of other issues that generally can be seen in a holistic response to people's concerns? The evidence that we've seen so far is that if you can intervene early, if you can wrap up the services that people need to remain a part of their community in work or in education or with the support of families, you can get a better result quicker. Now that's, as you quite rightly said at the start, that's not the only part of the solution. A longer term solution, or part of the solution rather, is for those smaller number, but sadly really intensive cases that do need the high level of residential based services for rehabilitation. And at the moment, that's an area that is clearly under strain in Victoria. And whilst we have over 200 state-funded residential rehabilitation beds across the state, the demand on those beds is huge.
It is too, because I know one of the people who I interviewed had a young daughter who had to go to Darwin because there wasn't any facilities here to help her.
So as part of the recognition of that, the federal government have been looking at their contribution to mental health and alcohol and drug services, and they have, through what they've now recast as the primary healthcare network system, looking at how they partner and invest with other agencies. Before stands, and it's my hope that as part of the discussions that we've had with the primary healthcare networks, including the Franks and the Peninsula area, that the federal government will start to invest in this very important area. This is too important an area to play politics with.
It is.
Because by the time you're in need of these beds,
it's too late.
You are, sadly, quite a sad case, a commitment that stands, and I'm at least hopeful that the initial discussions with the primary healthcare networks will start to see the federal government partner with us and local communities in delivering on those intensive rehabilitation beds.
Thank you so much, Minister, for your time today. I'll leave it there. Thank you.
No worries. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Minister. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That was the Victorian Minister for Health, Martin Foley, speaking with Deborah Maher. And if you want to know more about substance addiction, education sessions will be held next Monday at the Mornington Church of Christ at 6:30 p.m. and Wednesday the 27th of April at the Peninsula City Church, Frankston. There is a public forum on What's the Real Story with ICE. We will have more on the forum and an interview with Assistant Victorian Police Commissioner Stephen Fontana. You're listening to Eye on the Peninsula on RPPFM local radio with Piers Cunningham. Coming up in other stories we are following: the new standard for free-range eggs, fun from the Mornington BMW Cup, the winning jockey and owner talks to Deborah Maher. But now, will the reason why an outbreak of gastro at the Red Hill Consolidated School ever be revealed? Why people on the peninsula want jet skis out of the bay? And is the Mourne Penn Shire being transparent about the release councillor's spending? Station manager Brendan Telfer spoke with David Harrison on behalf of the Mourne Penn News to file this report.
David, a very good morning to you on behalf of Mourne Penn News. Welcome to RPPF again.
Thank you.
You do have some important things to tell us this morning.
We've got a parish pump issue, except it's not really when a school gets gastro and 106 pupils and 6 staff have to make themselves absent from school. Of course, we're in the middle of school holidays at the moment. There are some very angry parents who want to talk to the headmistress, Leanne Marshall, when school resumes next Monday.
We read about the outbreak and then I thought that they had it under control. So what is this? It's going on, is it?
There were some parents who wanted to tell their side of the story.
Oh, I see.
It's a tale of two stories. The education department says everything was fine. The problem, according to the parents, was lack of water and a school that sort of ran dry. They were told by people who were fixing the problem that the tank had dropped below 50%, which it's supposed to be kept above. And they claim that one of the people at the school said that we're not going to spend money on stuff that falls out of the sky. They couldn't flush the toilets at the school, I was told, nor could they wash their hands after using the toilets. The education department has come back with its version, saying that it was found that debris was blocking a pump valve, causing low pressure. The water was shut off for 10 to 20 minutes the following morning to repair a water pump, and that's when apparently the parents talked to the pairmen. They said at no time did the school run out of water. A number of parents rang the education department to try to find out what was going on, and one of the complaints that parents made was there's a certain lack of communication between the school and the school community, that is the parents and children.
What about this notion of jet skis on the Mornington Peninsula as well? How's that little issue going?
In searching for the jet ski side of it, I found a submission that the jet ski people had made to a marine inquiry in which they provided some quotes which fairly heavily endorsed what Councillor Hugh Fraser had been saying about jet skis and their danger. Not that that was their intention, and since then I've had a letter from somebody who wants to be heard on the matter, which I'll have to look at. People are concerned about jet skis. Everybody on the beach sees somebody who does something stupid within sight of the beach, and that's where they sort of get their reputation. They've got to follow rules. The things will go faster from 0 to 100 than any Maserati on the road.
Tell me about our Shire councillors. This overspend issue seems to be rolling on a little bit, David. What's going on here?
They were supposed to be, as I understand it, releasing a statement sometime during this week, but apparently the problem was too great for the communications people to produce something by our deadline on Friday afternoon.
So let's just wind it back a little bit and just explain for those that are coming across it for the first time that basically each Shire councillor has an appropriation of funds. It's something like $4,000, I think, for the duration.
They get more than that, but they have a number of allowance areas for travel, vehicle mileage, childcare, information, communication. education.
And in some cases, there's been a massive overspend by some shire councillors.
In conferences and training, an overspend was revealed for a couple of councillors, and those figures were challenged and have been revised. Now, it's the revised figures we're waiting on. The clear implication was that they would be released publicly. It is, after all, ratepayers' money, and I think we're entitled to know who spent it and how. They get $4,000 a year over the four-year term, so they get a total of $16,000. One councillor was in excess of $10,000 over that limit. We believe, from unofficial sources, that they're not going to release these figures on councillor spending until the annual budget, which is probably going to be in October. But if they follow normal practice, all they will release will be a précis of the current financial year's figures, which won't go into the sort of detail which the councillors have been provided with.
David Harrison, once again, thank you very much indeed for your time.
Always a pleasure.
David Harrison will update the Eye on the Peninsula regularly with important issues on the peninsula on behalf of Mornpen News.
Not sure what's happening in your community? Find out from the locals on RPP, Radio Port Phillip, 98.7 and 98.3 FM. Heard on the peninsula and beyond.
Consumers believe they are being misled after the free-range egg definition was announced last week by the state and federal consumer affairs ministers. Choice groups are calling on consumers to boycott 19 egg brands available on supermarket shelves. Deborah Maher talks to Keith, a local egg farmer.
Now, with the new rulings handed down last Thursday to label eggs free-range, should the producer run no more than 10,000 hens per hectare, do you think the new standards fairly fits the description of a free-range egg?
I have my doubts.
And why is that?
Anybody that's handled chickens for a period of time would understand that when they're free-range, I guess the consuming public would sort of think that they're roaming around. You know, a square metre per bird isn't a great deal. It's really a farming consideration. Nothing other than a stocking density. Not very long ago, parts of the industry were looking for that specification to be 55,000 birds per hectare. It's unbelievable when you think about it.
Choice spokesman Tom Godfrey said the new standards are preposterous and is calling on the ministers to follow CSIRO guidelines, which recommends 1,500 hens per hectare. Do you agree with Mr. Godfrey?
I'm not sure whether it should be down to 1,500, but I guess my own experience is about that density. That's the end of the spectrum. It's more appropriate.
Consumers' expectation of a free-range egg doesn't meet the new standard and believe they are paying too much at the checkout at supermarkets. Should the consumer be paying top dollar for what is labelled free-range, or is the cheapest caged produced egg better value? There is a petition put out by Choice Group to boycott 19 free-range egg producers that run 10,000 hens per hectare. Do you think this is a fair boycott?
I don't think that necessarily translates to appropriate action in the industry. The earlier commentary I heard early in the weekend indicated that the policeman on all this is going to be the ACCC. The greatest concern for the small producers, these are people that might have, let's say, up to 5,000 chickens at a guess. They can be run out of business for what's really an argument that's being waged by the large producers, people with, you know, 150,000 layers or double that.
In a statement issued on Thursday, Federal Small Business Minister Kelly O'Dwyer welcomed the new standard, saying it provides certainty for farmers, which will help encourage innovation and investment in the industry. As a past egg producer, do you agree with Minister O'Dwyer's statement?
It will certainly provide certainty for those large operators who earlier wanted an even higher density, and from the consuming public point of view, it's heading in a better direction than we've been before, but it's still ought to keep on going towards and head towards the CSIRO's measure,
which is 1,500 hens per hectare. Do you think that running 10,000 hens per hectare is humane?
I think it probably is. Too often we don't look at this from a chicken's point of view. I'll give you an example. If you've got a shed that's 15, 20 metres long and got 15 chickens in it, they'll all roost together because that's their biological thing. You can have as much room as you like.
Are you suggesting that even though they have some green area to run around in, supposedly, that they probably wouldn't even take advantage of that?
That's the likelihood that they will. Berg not even considered in this whole argument.
That was Keith talking about the new free-range egg definition that has consumers angry. You're listening to Eye on the Peninsula on RPPFM 98.7 or 98.3. The Frankston community is passionate about keeping the Anzac spirit alive. They are excited about the new location of the Frankston War Memorial at Beauty Park with the official unveiling this Sunday. But City of Frankston former Mayor Darryl Taylor faced squabbling and procrastination among councillors to get the project completed. Good morning, Darryl.
Good morning, Piers. Good morning, everyone.
You're an ex-serviceman who served in the Australian Army in different parts of the world, including East Timor in 2000, and now you work for the Department of Defence. What barriers did you face within the Frankston City Council a couple of years ago to get the project up and running?
Well, the barriers weren't just necessarily with the council itself. It was wider than that. There was discussions prior to my time on council around the site of the War Memorial. Everyone recognised that we needed to relocate from the current site. So the site was the area of debate.
Right.
And that was something we had to settle on pretty quickly, was where to relocate the new War Memorial.
Where exactly is it now? So it's a different location to where it was originally, or it's the same place but changed?
Relocated to the park behind the Frankston City Council itself, into Beauty Park, a great location, and a really, really nice place to have a memorial service.
So the barriers, I guess, were just convincing people that this was worth making this change, that it was going to be some tangible benefits to veterans and people who are interested in accessing the memorial.
The barriers weren't just around the location as well. There was barriers around, well, who should pay for it,
yep.
Barriers around what it should look like, the community groups involved. So it was really... The stakeholders were huge. Some councils weren't convinced it needed to relocate just yet. We cost constraints are involved. So
sure.
We had to really overcome all those areas of debate to eventually settle on a site, a design, and get on and construct it.
And is everyone happy with the design and end result, do you think?
Oh, absolutely, and everyone can be very proud with the result we've got. We've got the RSL involved. They gave us $25,000 up front and have committed $10,000 every year for the next 10 years. My wife, Jane, put together a community group, Women for Frankston War Memorial, which included the oldest veteran in Frankston, Phoebe Parker, as well. She's in her 90s. They would tin rattle. They'd go to the football. They'd go down the mall and get money. There's been tins out at shops on their counters. Other people have put in small amounts of money. So eventually we got the funds together. The councillors actually worked together very, very well to work on a design. So every councillor had input on the design. The old plaques from the old site have been relocated or embedded into the new design. It is an absolute credit to everyone and the hard work that we eventually got there, and the result is absolutely stunning.
Fantastic. So the official opening of the Frankston War Memorial is this coming Sunday?
This Sunday at 10 o'clock.
Yep.
We'll be officially opening the War Memorial, and after the opening we'll have an actual memorial service.
Okay, fantastic. And that's at Beauty Park
at Beauty
in Frankston.
Park.
Can you explain what QR codes are, and will there be an installation of QR codes at the War Memorial Park?
Well, that's... I've just had a discussion with the radio station around the QR codes, and I think that having a meeting with the mayor and the CEO about them would be very beneficial. The QR code is where you swipe your code on against a code, and you'll get a visual and audio experience on what you're looking at.
Blocks of
like a barcode,
like a barcode,
yeah.
Which you can scan with your phone, and then that'll trigger something in your phone.
That's
or
right.
Trigger an app, which gives you some additional information.
That's right.
Sounds like a great idea.
Yes.
For a while, the number of people attending Anzac marches dwindled, but there's definitely been a shift in people's thinking in more recent times. Why do you think that is?
I think the centenary of Anzac has really highlighted or started to raise people's awareness in Anzac Day. 10 years ago, you get about 500 to an Anzac Day service or a memorial service. Now we're getting about 5,000. But a lot of work's been done by state governments and federal governments in the lead up to the Centenary Anzac over personalising people's stories. So a lot of initiatives, for example, putting plaques on houses where veterans from World War One used to live, going into schools and educating the children, a lot of activities based around World War One, based around Anzac Day. And I think the nation has really stirred over what it those men and women went through, just over 100 years ago to defend at the freedoms that we experience today. So it's very, very pleasing. The growth in the youth attendance is huge, and I think it's a great credit to parents, to schools, to the veterans community, RSLs, to get youth involved and understand. And they really do relate. They stand there and think, well, that man was in these circumstances when he was my age, and they cannot visualise what that would be like to do that. So it's a fantastic story, and it's getting bigger. And as a veteran, I'm very, very proud that the nation is starting to resonate and understand World War One, World War Two, and what our predecessors went through to protect the freedoms that
and
we have.
It's a four-year commemoration, isn't it, of the Great War? So it started in 2014. It goes through to 2018. So yes. 100 years from beginning to end.
Yeah, and that's another great initiative they brought in. They weren't just going to celebrate Anzac Day, they're going to commemorate the Great War and certain camp battles and what have you along the way. So yes, it's a four-year commemoration, and that's a great initiative, because that will really educate and allow the Anzac story or the World One story to grow.
We've been talking to Australian Army ex-serviceman and Frankston's ex-mayor Darryl Taylor. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Piers, and congratulations on the new show too.
Thank you very much. Barisha is the four-year-old gelding that won the Mornington BMW Cup on Saturday. Deborah Maher caught up with owner and breeder of Barisha, Mr. Simon Cox, and Daniel Moore, the jockey who rode him across the post by a short nose.
We bred the horse and wasn't fashionable stallion, and we left him on the farm. He was broken in by Murray Johnson, who had him till his first three or four starts, and Robert Smurden's current clients made an offer. We sold him and kept his share, and we're here today. He hasn't been an easy horse to train, so Robert's done a fantastic job. Delighted that he's managed to do what he can do on the big day, because that's always a challenge.
How was he feeling, do you think?
Oh, he was very calm today, and he's come a long way in his 18 starts. But early on, he was a bit of a misfit. Couldn't concentrate, very hard to handle, but he's matured.
Daniel, congratulations. What was the beautiful Barisha like to ride today?
He was a gentleman, actually. He gave me no grief at all throughout the run. He was a little bit slow away, and he was a long way out the back tail off, but he rested really well, and he was really effective at the end of the 2,500 metres, which I was wrapped with.
Now, I understand that a little bit of a hard temperament to deal with. How did you deal with that today?
Well, I just let him be the boss. I was the pip on the pumpkin, and just let him do his thing, and he was the boss. So I just played into his hands a little bit and made him think that all was sweet. But no, butter wouldn't melt in his mouth today. He was excellent.
Just quickly, in the barriers, was he a little bit flighty, or did you think he actually had a chance to win today?
I thought he had a good chance of running very well, but no, he was very relaxed in the gates, and everything went to plan pretty much.
Vice Chairman of Melbourne Racing Club, Mr. Peter LeBrand, had this to say about the event and the merger between the Mornington Racing Club and the Melbourne Racing Club.
The Melbourne Racing Club embraced Mornington right from the word go, and we've spent a lot of money on enhancing the facilities here. We've spent over $5 million on the grandstand and the members' facilities and the public facilities to encourage people to come to the racing and come down to the peninsula, not just for the peninsula, people coming from the metropolitan area, to get them involved in the peninsula. This is such a growing area and such a great area. We've got a great council who are supportive of all these works that have undertaken. And I think it's just growing and growing. If you only look at the crowd today, it was overcast this morning, the sun's out, they'll come out in droves and they love it. This is only the second year that we've had it on a Saturday afternoon, and this will grow and get bigger. We've also spent a lot of money on the track and the other facilities around the place to enhance the course and to make it very amenable for families to come too. Bring the kids and come down and sit on the lawns and enjoying it. Young members that want to join. We've got a separate membership for Mornington members if they want to just come to Mornington, not go to the other tracks at Sandown and Caulfield. So it really is the place to be.
Adding to that, you're attracting, or we are attracting down here in Mornington, fantastic jockeys and huge sponsors. Just talk us through that a little bit.
When you start improving things and putting on good races, you're going to get the good horses, you're going to get the good trainers and jockeys, and of course the trainers want to be on board at all. Now, the more sponsorship we get, of course, the more we can put back into racing. And as you said, with the jockeys wanting to come down here and the good horses, like you see, the Freedmans have brought Tom Melbourne down here today to run the Mornington Cup, which we expect will win. And that winner of this Mornington Cup gets an automatic entry into the prestigious Caulfield Cup, which is the greatest mile and a half race in the world.
And also Michelle Payne's here. We're excited about that. She's in nearly every race today.
She is. It's great to see her back riding. She's been, I won't say distracted, it's probably a bit hard, but she's certainly had a lot of other things to attend to. And she's well loved by everybody. She's the first lady to win a Melbourne Cup. Would be great to see her win the Mornington Cup if she could. But look, now, great to see Michelle back here riding. And she's got a lot of ability. You can't underestimate her ability. And what she's achieved in her 30 years is quite remarkable. We all support Michelle and love her dearly.
But how is she dealing with the media and all the attention?
She has had to go and get management to look after her affairs and plan all her things because it just got too big. You can't be a jockey and be somebody and trying to run all these other things. And she's got a good management company and that's working very well. And I think it's very beneficial for her financially.
And the general manager of the Mornington Racing Club, Stephen Bell, had this to add.
The merge has probably been at its best when you see the winner of the Mornington Cup now gets automatically into the Caulfield Cup, which has attracted a full field today of everyone trying to make sure that not only they win a $300,000 race today, but they go on to win $2.5 million later on.
What are the crowd numbers here, do you estimate?
Oh, I reckon so far we've got about 8,500, so hoping, you know, there's still more coming, as I said, for the Cup, which will be up on last year. Obviously, 2 years ago, we've changed it from a Wednesday to a Saturday meeting. We've seen growth from last year already, so that's a positive all round.
Then more punters could come down from the city and people then could experience a great day in Mornington.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, having on a Saturday, you know, we're doing some research, which I can share later on, but we're hoping that the people are going to stay down here. They're going to use the accommodation, they're going to use their holiday houses, and obviously, more importantly, they're going to have breakfast at the restaurants tomorrow, they're going to have dinner tonight, and everything will go really well. So from a local community point of view, I think we should be all very proud of ourselves. It's the cup for the locals. They love the Mornington Cup. They love the Mornington Racing Club. So let's not ever lose sight that this is a local day.
Up on memberships?
Membership flying at the minute, which is great. So it dipped for a little while, and now it's come back. Obviously, where we're standing here, Deborah, it's a $5 million redevelopment that we undertook, and this is all about for the members. So, you know, I'm looking over your left shoulder right now, but it's absolutely packed right now in the members, which is great.
The excitement of the Cup was felt around the track with some lucky ladies.
Well, it's a great day, very busy on track, and it should be a good Cup.
Okay, Amy, going across to you now. Just tell us a little bit about your racing experiences. Do you often come to the races?
Brooke actually includes me in a lot of her experiences, so it's always lovely to be invited. I do love it. It's always a good day. And the Mornington one has been good because it's quite local for me, being a peninsula girl. So it's a nice little community difference compared to the Melbourne runs. So it's nice.
Just talk about the champagne that we're drinking and the beautiful food that we're eating.
Yes, now that has been lovely. Nothing like a nice bit of French champagne on a Saturday afternoon, and the food has been beautiful actually. It's been a very lovely day.
The Mornington BMW Cup is the most celebrated days on the local racing calendar. Deborah Maher there enjoying her day. That's it for this edition of Eye on the Peninsula. Hope you can tune in to 98.7 FM or live stream from our website, rppfm.com.au. You can also download the RPPFM app. If you missed any Eye on the Peninsula programs, podcasts are available on our website. Thank you for listening. I'm Piers Cunningham.